from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this special Memorial Day edition of Forum, two interviews from Forum's archives. First, journalist Elizabeth Colbert joins us to talk about her new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, and how humans may be contributing to the next mass extinction. Then at 9:30, we explore the beauty of the California wilderness with historian Jared Farmer. His new book, Trees in Paradise, tells the story of four state trees, the redwood, the palm, the eucalyptus, and the citrus tree, and how they help shape California's history. That's coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to a special encore edition of Forum. By most scientific lights, there have been five mass extinctions on the Earth over the last half billion years, the most recent 66 million years ago when an asteroid collided with the Earth. With a number of species on Earth presently vanishing at an unnatural rate due to a range of different human-made factors, we are, according to Elizabeth Colbert, on the brink perhaps of a sixth mass extinction. This is the title, actually, Mass Extinction, of the New Yorker staff writer's newest book, which has been widely compared in its impact by a number of different sources to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. She's also the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, which we talked about with her here on Forum. And she joins us here in the studio this morning for our second hour. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Well, let me give listeners some statistics here that are right from your work. A third of all reef-building corals, a third of all freshwater mollusks, a third of all sharks and rays, a quarter of all mammals, and a fifth of all reptiles and a sixth of all birds are all headed toward oblivion or extinction. I don't know where the good news is in that, but, you know, it's some might say, well, elevated extinction doesn't necessarily mean mass extinction or full extinction. I'm sure you've heard that argument. You say what?
Well, that's true. I mean, we are clearly at a time of very high extinction rates. You know, whether we rise to the level of the five major mass extinctions of the last half billion years, you know, certainly remains to be determined. There have also been somewhat oxymoronically minor mass extinctions in the record. And, you know, where this extinction event is going to fit into that is obviously impossible to know when you're, you know, in the midst of it. But increasingly, you hear scientists comparing us to the asteroid, you know, that killed off the dinosaurs and many other groups, I should say. The dinosaurs always get top billing.
I got to jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because there are those who say, no, it wasn't necessarily the asteroid. It's not incontrovertible. I know you write about the Alvarezes. Father and son, and how they seem to make it incontrovertible. But is it really that the asteroid was?
Well, we're just at the 30 year. We just passed the 30 year mark of their landmark paper on that subject. And on the occasion of that, there was a journal article in Science written by many, many prominent scientists saying, yes, the evidence is in. This is obviously a murder mystery that's 65 million years old. So the trail is pretty cold, let's put it that way. But based on all of the available evidence, the pretty broad consensus is that, yes, it was an asteroid impact. There are certainly people who will still argue that. There are people who will argue anything in the scientific world,
to be honest. Religious arguments about the dinosaurs.
Yes,
but there are also arguments, I remember, about evolution and birds and dinosaurs and all that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, many, many issues will be debated in science for quite a long time. But I think as much as things can be settled when we're talking about evidence that's 66 million years old, I think this one is heading towards settlement. How's that?
Well, also heading towards settlement are all these many factors that you key in on and write so, may I say, fluidly and trenchantly about. And we're talking about climate change, of course, which you've done a lot of work on before this book, carbon emissions being absorbed in the ocean, all that changing chemistry of the ocean. And frankly, many other things. I mean, the rainforests. But the thing that really, I suppose, people don't know that much about are the invasive species. And that's big.
Yeah. Invasive species actually are implicated in, some people would say, the majority of extinctions that we know about. Invasive species turn out to be really important. And one of the points that I make in the book is, you know, it's not my point. It's really a point that biologists make, is that what we're doing is effectively about 250 million years ago, all of the continents of the world were smushed together in this supercontinent that's been called Pangaea. And then they drifted apart due to plate tectonics, and we have eventually got the world as we know it, right, with seven continents. But what we're doing by bringing together all of the flora and fauna of the world just by transporting things around the world effectively in a biological sense is erasing those boundaries between the continents and smushing them back together. So a term has been coined, the new Pangaea. We're creating the new Pangaea. We're bringing everything back together. And that can have, it turns out, very devastating consequences. Often it has no consequences, right? You move something around the world, it can't make it in a new place, so it just disappears, or it establishes itself and it doesn't do any damage. It just sort of coexists with what was there before. But a certain percentage of the time, and even if it's a very small percentage, but you're doing it over and over again, it obviously adds up. A certain percentage of the time, you bring together these evolutionary lineages that have been separated for tens of millions of years, and very devastating things happen.
Well, let's talk about some of those devastating things. Brown tree snakes, for example, came from Papua New Guinea in the 1940s. They were put into Guam and probably on a military ship, I guess, from what we've been able to deduce. It just ate things up, literally ate things up. I mean, native birds, native mammals, all of the bats except maybe one. And then you've also got the example of this Central African wolf snail, which was introduced in Hawaii about a decade after that in the 1950s. And again, it's killed off about 90% of the native snail species. I mean, these are the kinds of things that we really are dealing with.
Yeah, the snail story is a really interesting one because the snails of Hawaii, they're like Darwin's finches. They're not as famous. They weren't as... Well, Darwin's finches are actually not very colorful either, but these snails were I guess, not very charismatic. But it's a case where, you know, a very small number of snails reached the Hawaiian Islands, and they radiated out into different niches, different islands to inhabit different habitats. There were something like 700 species of snails on the Hawaiian archipelago. And then what happened was there was an invasive snail that got to Hawaii, and it was an agricultural pest. And so people said, well, we want to get rid of this snail. We're going to bring in this giant African snail that's going to eat that snail. But lo and behold, the giant African snail did not want to eat the agricultural pest snail. It only really was fond of the native snails. And so, as you mentioned, something like between 75 and 90% of the Hawaiian Islands' original species of snails are now gone or very, very, you know, headed towards oblivion.
Despite the good intentions. I mean, it makes me think of T.J. Boyle's novel. I mean, it really is right out of that scenario.
Absolutely. And there are many examples of this where something is brought in to control something else. So, for example, in Australia, I'm sure people have heard about the cane toad, which is this, you know, enormous fat toad. It was brought in to eat beetles that were eating sugar. Instead, it's just devastated native fauna. It's poisonous, the African cane toad. And so things try to eat it. Other, you know, like mammals will try to eat it and they will drop dead. It's had a devastating effect. So our record in terms of, you know, it's sort of like I know an old woman, you know, who swallowed a fly and then she swallowed whatever. I can't remember the lyrics of the song. Then she swallowed something else.
I don't know why she swallowed
a fly. I don't know why, right. And then she swallowed something else, though. And so we can compound the problem of one introduction with another introduction. And nowadays, actually, this has happened often enough and been devastating enough that scientists are very, very reluctant to introduce a species purposefully without massive, massive testing to see what's going to happen.
How do all these fungal diseases get into the arteries and veins of human history? I mean, they threaten really every species here in America and every amphibian species on the planet. And I think you said that one of the most gruesome things you saw was up in Vermont in a fungus cave inside of a cave.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story that actually unfolded, you know, literally as I was writing this book. And that is a story of a fungus. It's since been traced back to Europe. It came over quite possibly on someone's shoe or, you know, in their suitcase. It almost certainly landed somewhere in upstate New York because that's where we first started to see these huge die-offs. It's very devastating to bats. It gets on their skin. It irritates their skin. You can see it. It's white nose syndrome. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of it. It's called white nose syndrome. It looks like the bats have been dunked in talcum powder or cocaine, some people have said. And what happens is that bats in the northeastern U.S. hibernate during the winter. So they hang by their toes, their body temperature drops, their immune system shuts down, and they really, really need to conserve energy. They're very small little creatures. They need that energy to get through the winter. There's nothing to eat. And this fungus irritates them. They wake up. They fly around. There's nothing to eat. They drop dead. And that cave that you were alluding to, I went there right after this fungus reached Vermont. It was a cave that used to have hundreds of thousands of hibernating bats, and hundreds of thousands of them had dropped from the ceiling of the cave onto the ground, were decomposing. It was really a horrific, horrific sight. And that is a case of something that was introduced totally unconsciously. We have no idea who did it. They have no idea who they were, that has come from one continent to another and had terrible effects.
Talking with Elizabeth Colbert, New Yorker Magazine staff writer and author of a new book called The Sixth Extinction. And let's talk, though, about all the CO2 going into the atmosphere, because when you talk about the other extinctions about 250 million years ago, there was another one that involved CO2 from a volcanic event, which is a little bit eerie. I mean, this one, if it's going to happen, is our fault. This one is clearly made by humans. But the ocean density changes are really what we're talking about, to some degree, maybe perhaps even more than the atmospheric changes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if you look at, you know, if you talk to scientists, certainly if you talk to marine scientists, one thing that really, really worries them that has not gotten, I guess, the press it deserves, let's put it that way, is this issue, as you say, of ocean acidification, it's called. And that's the phenomenon where when you pour CO2 into the air, as we are, you know, there's just no debate about that. We're pouring about 10 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere every year, you know, just by burning fossil fuels. A lot of it ends up in the ocean just because we're, you know, the oceans cover a lot of the planet. They cover, you know, 70% of the surface of the planet. And wherever you have an interface between water and air, you just get an exchange of gases. So you pour CO2 into the air, a lot of it's going to end up in the oceans. And that's what's happening. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms a weak acid. It forms carbonic acid. So people drink it, I mean, Diet Pepsi, for example, but it's still an acid. And it's changing the chemistry of the oceans very radically. And as you allude to, the worst mass extinction in the history of the planet happened about 250 million years ago at the end of what's known as the Permian period. And it's believed that it was caused by this major sort of burst of volcanic activity that emitted a lot of CO2 into the air and warmed the planet very radically and changed the chemistry of the oceans very radically. And very soberingly, scientists have recently tried to, you know, figure out, okay, at what rate was CO2 being emitted at that point? And the best estimate that they can come up with, this is a pretty recent paper, suggests that we are pouring CO2 into the air faster than was poured into the air in the events leading up to the end Permian extinction. So you increasingly hear, I have heard very serious scientists say, you know, we cannot rule out that kind of an outcome, the end Permian, which was the worst mass extinction in history. I find that, even I, who wrote this book and feel like, you know, I couldn't be surprised by much anymore, find that, you know, just extremely sobering and terrifying, really, I guess.
There's a lot that's alarming in this book. I mean, there's no getting around it. It's grim, and yet we knew about extinction theories before we even knew about evolutionary theories. That's the irony sort of a lot of people don't recognize. And let's talk a little bit about Georges Cuvier, the guy who gave us pterodactyl and was actually a French anatomist, way ahead of his time. He understood extinction theory.
Yeah, he was a really interesting guy. He's one of these people whom history has sort of shortchanged. I guess I'm going to speak on his behalf. And he, to understand his contribution here.
Excuse me, people don't like to believe catastrophism. They just don't like to accept it.
No,
still to this
no.
day, they're hearing you and probably you.
Exactly. We're gonna hear from them. But to appreciate his contribution, and I should also add that he made contributions in many different fields. He was a very, very gifted scientist. you have to go back before him and realize that people just didn't believe in extinction, even though they were increasingly, as Europeans went to the New World, uncovering these really weird bones that they had really hard time explaining. So, for example, mastodons, American mastodon bones, had been shipped to Europe. People had a really hard time explaining them. They thought, well, maybe these bones belong to elephants. Maybe they belong to hippos. You got all sorts of interesting and wrong theories.
Including Thomas Jefferson's.
Thomas Jefferson. At one point, this animal was called an incognitum, right? Just an unknown. And Thomas Jefferson was one of those people. He loved fossils. He loved natural history. But he was one of those people who firmly believed that nothing had gone extinct. Nothing could go extinct. And when he sent Lewis and Clark to the Northwest, he expected them to find mastodons or incognitums roaming around. He was firmly convinced of that. And then Cuvier came along and said pretty simply, if they were out there, we would have seen them. So it was not a brilliant act of, you know, scientific research. It was just sort of a commonsensical conclusion. And he was right. He posited a whole lost world, in fact, and he found many, many. He had people send him their fossils from all over Europe. As you say, he named the pterodactyl. That's where we get that. He named the mastodon. There are many names that we get from Cuvier. And eventually he came to realize that there had been many lost worlds, as it were, that there were different fauna at different times. And he was the first person, for example, to realize that there had been sort of this age of reptiles that preceded the age of mammals.
With all the species gone, and you do write about, the golden frog and the great auk, which was hunted down, and animals like the mastodon simply no longer a part of this planet, you get into almost what amounts to a kind of prognosticating when you say that by half a century, by the end of the century, half the species will be gone. I mean, that's pretty much the scientific take on it.
Well, I think people would say, they would issue a couple caveats to that, and I hope those caveats come through in the book. First of all, one thing is predicated on, you know, those estimates are based sort of on continuing to do what we're doing. So continuing, for example,
that's a positive estimate. You read James Lovelock and others.
Yes, to say even less, right. And I think they would say committed to extinction. So if we continue, for example, to pour CO2 into the air and into the water at current rates, people have tried to model what will happen to the climate, what will happen to the oceans. And they would say, you know, sort of best estimates are that, you know, somewhere on the order, we're talking orders of magnitude here, will be committed to extinction by the end of the century. So there will be marching off towards extinction, and it will be, you know, virtually impossible to get them back. How's that?
That's sensible. But a lot of people think the coral reefs are our canary in the coal mine. I mean, that's a whole ecosystem.
Yes, and the prognosis for coral reefs is really, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's really grim, and that is
that, how can you sugarcoat it?
Yeah, it's impossible to sugarcoat. There are definite, you know, many marine scientists believe that coral reefs will be the first, you know, major ecosystem to be just done in by human impact. So there will still be corals, you know, but they will no longer be able to form these fantastic reefs that support a tremendous variety of species. Anywhere between 500,000 and something like 9 million species spend part of their lives on coral reefs. And any of your listeners who have ever been to an intact reef, which is harder and harder to find, I should say, will know that just when you look down into a reef ecosystem and you see this amazing profusion of life that you just never see on land, really. It's just extraordinary. It's an extraordinary experience.
And that's, again, acidification of the ocean to a great degree, but also fishermen dynamiting. You know?
Well, there are a lot of things that are affecting reefs right now. For example, changing water temperatures are really dramatically affecting reefs. Reefs have this interesting symbiosis going on. They have algae inside them, basically, that feed them, that provide carbohydrates for them, and they get a lot of their energy from. And when water temperatures get too high, this relationship breaks down. They expel them, and they basically starve to death. So coral bleaching, those bleaching events people have heard about, which are happening more and more frequently because of water temperatures are going up. Those are already really reducing coral cover in a lot of parts of the world. So, for example, in the Great Barrier Reef, which is the world's largest reef, coral cover has declined by something like 50% just in the last few decades.
Let me ask you about population and how that figures into this whole equation. If you would have listened to Paul Ehrlich, we would have been extinct years ago. But the fact of the matter is we're pretty much using up our resources, and the Earth can't – there's a kind of carrying capacity here that can't sustain the population.
Well, I think that that's one of the big questions, and I guess one of the questions that is implicit in the book is, you know, is it possible that we – you know, are so clever, humans are really, really clever and very, very adaptable, that we can, you know, go on for quite a long time, even as other species drop out, but that maybe we're using the resources that otherwise other species would have used. So, you know, is it ourselves that are in danger, or is it really everything that we share the planet with? This is a question that, you know, is really hard to answer.
Well, there's some who think the answer is going to be technology, new paradigm. You know, that's going to save us because we have resilience, because we're so inventive.
Yes, and I think that that is certainly possible. The question, I suppose, comes with any new technology, you know, does it also have impacts on other creatures that we, you know, are not necessarily able even to anticipate, right? So a lot of these things, you know, when people started to burn fossil fuels, they didn't anticipate that they were changing the climate and changing the chemistry of the oceans. And the next technology that comes along may be very beneficial for humans. And I guess a question I would ask is it going to be beneficial, you know, for everything else?
Well, we can't learn a lot from past extinctions because some of them go so far back, as you've indicated. But the pattern of survival, I think you've said, has to do with just how many groups are involved in, so to speak, or a lot of species are more apt to survive, I think we can conclude, you've suggested.
Well, when people have gone back and, you know, people are actually very interested, actively interested in this question precisely because we seem to be in another mass extinction event. What comes through? What does tend to come through these extinction events? And they've found very, very few rules. You know, it's very hard to say that there's a rule here. The dinosaurs, you know, were the dominant group on Earth for tens of millions of years. And they all, every species of non-avian dinosaur died out. Why is that? No one really knows.
Here's a listener who writes, this assumes that humans are above nature. I'm one that believes that we are a part of nature and what we do is perfectly natural on the evolutionary scale. The Great Lakes come to mind as an example. As industry rose, the heavy metal content of wastewater rose and drained into the Great Lakes. The fish populations dropped dramatically and then rebounded. As the rebound occurred, new environmental standards were imposed for wastewater and the heavy metals had to be removed. As a result, the heavy metal concentration dropped in the lakes and the fish populations again dropped dramatically. The point is, as long as a species is not fully eradicated, it's selecting for physical and behavioral traits. Slow adaptation is better than abrupt changes, as exampled in the lakes.
Well, I mean, this whole question of are we natural and are we unnatural? I don't claim to have the ultimate answer for that. I mean, I think one of the
I do. It's unnatural to destroy the planet. How's that?
Okay. I mean, is an asteroid natural? You know, if you wanted to find the great, you know, geological forces as natural, then, you know, we're up there with those now, and we're also natural. And if you want to say that destroying the planet's unnatural, then we're unnatural. And I guess my point is only that we're very, very unusual. Natural or unnatural, we're extremely, extremely unusual in the history of life on this planet.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was journalist Elizabeth Colbert discussing her recent book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. She is a staff writer for The New Yorker and also the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Stay with us for more programs from our archives. Here's what's coming up on Forum in our second hour this morning for a special Memorial Day edition from our archives. We revisit my conversation with jazz musician Marcus Shelby about the legacy of Duke Ellington. And then at 10:30, singer Linda Ronstadt reflects on her 40-year career, her political activism, and her ongoing battle with Parkinson's. And tomorrow on Forum, a discussion about frequently mispronounced names, from ethnic names to hard-to-spell names, and how that affects how you treat or are treated by other people. That's all coming up on Forum here on KQED Public Radio.